What is it that makes the wheel of Dhamma roll along within us? What are the factors of our path? It doesn't help us just to memorize lists, but it does help us to look at what we're actually doing and see if we're putting in the right ingredients. Like when you set out to prepare a meal, you use certain ingredients and not others, depending on what you're making. So I would like to encourage this kind of contemplation of the ingredients that we add into everyday life through the intentions, the attitudes, the objectives, the choices that we make day by day. What are we actually doing? That's really where the Buddha's teaching comes in so strongly. None of us are immune to suffering. It will come to all of us. Even at the time when we feel like it's the darkest, it's the most disabling time emotionally, mentally, even in that, there is a way through. There is a way out. These dark moments, they're just the conditions of human life. And if we didn't have these challenges, we wouldn't bother searching for a way out. We would just be lost in pleasure. So gratitude plays a very big role in all this. It's a way of turning the mind to, what can I learn from this suffering? Who is suffering? What can I tease out of it is, in fact, the key to opening the door of the heart. Because then we come to the question of, who is it? Who is this being, this person that is suffering? What is the mind getting caught up in that deters it or deflects it from knowing the truth of the fearlessness within fear? The freedom that we can gain from all our struggle, all of it. This is an extraordinary teaching. It's not an ordinary teaching, and it requires us to look so carefully at what we're actually thinking and how we spend our time moment by moment. So gratitude gives the mind immediately a standard that we can defer to. Gratitude in this moment. The nature of suffering. And the nature of impermanence. All our loved ones, even our health, physical and mental, we have it, it's there, and then it disappears. So we have to ponder these things, not in terms of, that's too bad, how can I prevent that? But in terms of, what can I learn from this impermanent tide that is constantly washing over my days, my life, my experience, moment by moment? No moment can be repeated. It can't last. But what we gain from that, when we reflect mindfully, carefully, penetratingly into the truth of where this experience arises and how it ceases, then we're beginning to investigate in a way that can free the mind from attachment to experience. And that would be a moment of deep awareness and a moment of waking up. But the mind is so fascinated or fearful of that, fascinated by life or fearful of losing what we think is ours, that such investigation can be very frightening. A mystical aspect of experience is beyond thought, beyond tradition, beyond concept, beyond ritual, beyond convention. So I do believe that when love, unconditional love, is fully matured in a human being, then enlightenment doesn't have an ism on it. Even the Buddha was not a Buddhist. He was awake. He was fully enlightened. And he was able to teach in such a way that you could actually follow and fulfill the path, not to be lost in ideas. We can speak so many languages, but the most powerful language of all is silence. Going into the silence of the heart. And many beings discover that just through their suffering. Just through their enormous suffering. There are many ways to bring the path to life in your daily practice. Some people use faith. They don't have a plan. They just trust. And they go to the present moment with faith, clarity, yoni somani sipara. They are wisely reflecting moment by moment on their experience. And they delve into that and dive into that and use the truths of knowing impermanence, suffering, and the emptiness moment by moment, and then allowing the reflection and investigation of mind states to realize the wisdom, the insight in that stillness, until the mind is purified. So we need to be very careful that the ingredients of the Eightfold Path are taking life in us for the path consciousness to develop. But without the sila component, which is right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the whole system fails to take off. It's like the airplane is missing oil or something is not functioning. And then our meditation practice comes into that psychophysical environment. It's not just we have to be healthy, we have to be attentive, we have to make effort, we have to apply a physical effort as well as a mental effort, and they need to be balanced. Also, we have to have trust that this system works. If we don't trust it, even if we have the right intention, as soon as fear arises, we don't let go of it because we're too scared. So the other qualities can't really fulfill themselves, and the plane never takes off. The ship doesn't leave the harbor. And that's not uncommon. In the process of developing right thought or right intention, which is the intention to abandon defilement, then right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration are added into that. And then right view begins to develop. Once we develop enough wisdom to realize where we're headed, our right view will grow as those four qualities develop. And our sila has to be a parallel development with those. We can't forget the sila at all. So there you are. Our life activities, our choice of who we work for, how we work, who we choose to live with, how we live, how we speak, how we even treat the animals, insects, everything, the environment, ourselves. So the treatment of the mind is foremost. And this is the Dhammapada speaking. Mind is the forerunner of all things. All things are mind made. When the mind is purified, and when we do well mentally, then our happiness, our joy will follow us. And we will fulfill the path. But without that kind of joyfulness, that kind of rejoicing in goodness and rejoicing in the purity of the mind, then we can sit forever, but nothing much will come of it. The ship will not leave the harbor. We have to equip our ship properly and know that we're going to be at sea and the waves will be big. So we have to be brave. And we have to hold on. I remember when I was 22, I sailed across the Atlantic Ocean in a boat with three other people. And it took us 6 weeks to cross. And I had to learn how to have one hand on the boat at all times. That's why you're called a hand. Somebody who assists to sail a boat is called a hand. Because you don't have two hands on a boat. You only have one. Because you must always hold on. If you fall over on a sailboat in the middle of the ocean, you might never be picked up again. So we always had to hold on. It's the same with the Dhamma. We always have to hold on to the Dhamma no matter what we're doing. If we lose our hold on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, we're going to fall into the ocean and drown. The ocean of samsara is deep and dangerous, and it's all around us. So we have to be careful who we hang out with, what we read, what websites do we visit. This is becoming more and more of a concern. How are we spending our time? To die before death, magapala, maga is the moment of realization of nibbana, is a maga moment. But maga is also the path. Visuddhi maga is the path of purification. This word maga actually means death, a dying, and also a receiving. But what is actually happening is the death of the world. When the mind goes to that level of purification, the world is dead. A part of our connection, our attachment to the world dies in that moment. But what we're touching is the deathless. So the attainment, there is no attainment. There's no one to attain, but it's a knowledge, a knowing, this deathless. The magga refers to an empty space. A space which is empty, but it's honored for its own sake. We sometimes get caught up with worshiping emptiness. But that worship could also be just conceptual. It's not an experience. But to experience the deathless means that we die to the impure within us, level by level. And the more that we die to that which is impure in us, the more we open up that empty space and we honor it for its own sake. We don't honor it as something special. It is just that which is to be honored, not as compared to other things. It's incomparable. But we tend to say, well, this is special compared to that, or this is better than that. But there is no this and there is no that. There's the loss of comparison. There's the loss of thinking. We can't even speak about it. It's absolutely incomparable, absolutely still, absolutely silence. It is without death, so it doesn't die. There's nothing to die in that. So it's a conundrum. It's called the deathless because it's permanent. We can't conceive of this because all we know in our life is the impermanent. Everything is impermanent. Suddenly, the mind touches that which is permanent, and it is opposite to even the mind itself. There is no mind. There's just consciousness, purified awareness. So in touching that state, one can only marvel. One can only experience the happiness of that. It's wordless. And this is how we transcend the world. This is how we transcend suffering. Suffering teaches us about impermanence. When we learn about impermanence, then suffering is no longer a problem. Because in it, we can see that which is death-bound. And we know that whatever is death-bound is not worth struggling for. Then we stop struggling when we know that. The self has the pin removed. When the underpinning of self-view and self-thought is removed, then there is no suffering, because suffering happens when the self fears dying or the self becomes obsessed with continuing, with being. So those are the ways that we suffer. But when we unpin and deconstruct the self permanently, suffering cannot arise. That's the death of the world. Then the world dies. And so we continue being in the world, but the way that we are with the world is not self-bound. It's not feeding self. It's just feeding truth. It's upholding that which is ultimately true. Then the reason for our practice, the reason for this path, takes on a completely different dimension. It's about transcending samsara. It's not to get to some special place. It's to understand and realize that which is incomparable. Understanding, ultimate beyond the supreme awakening. I have a very beautiful quote from the Dhammapada, which speaks to that. How much longer are we going to allow the mind to swing around and cavort so wildly? Look and see. It is right there in the center of the agitation that the non-agitated mind lies waiting. So when we are struggling, if we can investigate the struggle itself, the agitation itself, right there in the center of it is the truth of non-agitation. Right in the middle of our sorrow is the truth of joy, of great peace. Because the sorrow is always concerned with what we don't have, with what we lose. And so there's the self. Yes. Had something, it's gone, we suffer, we struggle. Me, mine, myself. And we just stop making that, feeding it, believing in it, creating it. We just stop. When the mind stops long enough and is silent long enough, investigating the silence and going more and more deeply into it, the whole act of investigation also disappears. Then there is no separation between awareness and the unconditioned. So then awareness falls into the unconditioned and does not return for a moment. With full enlightenment, it just stays with the unconditioned. That's the true blessing of true deeply, deeply realizing this teaching. Waking up. So that's when we die before we die. The body is still alive, but the mind is purified for the benefit of all.